session number 27074, reel 3.
Squadron Leader Bamberger, reel 3. At that stage with the training, would you then have training how to make sort of precautionary landings?
Any flying training is basically, apart from getting the airplane up and down safely, is in case things go wrong. And you trained, did precautionary landings, you did landings where you came in low down, you did practice engine failures on landing. You'd been around the airfield, and the trainer would cut the your instructor would cut the engine, and you'd have to land it. So, I mean, so much of, and then you'll be flying along. You know it's going to come, and the instructor would throttle back on the engine and say, pick a field and land, you see? And you had to try and, in a few minutes or less, to find a field you think you could go down in safely. And, of course, you could do these things before the war. But you didn't actually land. As soon as you were near landing, the instructor would say, I've got it, need open up the engine, we'd go fly off, you see. But apart from knowing how to learn how to use your airplane as a weapon, most flying instruction is how to cope when things go wrong.
And is there anything that you have to remember, obviously, if you have an engine failure or while you were training, what are the principles that you have to remember that you have to do to get that aircraft down safely?
Well, I vaguely remember at one time being told by an instructor, and remember, I'm talking about the fairly early days of aviation, when you're flying somewhere or navigating somewhere, always keep a lookout for a suitable field you can land in. You think you can always bear it in mind. I don't keep looking all the time, because engine failure in those days was greater than it is now. I can't remember what you said now.
It was just about the engine failure, what the technique was for, what you had to remember should you have had an engine failure.
Well, if you had engine failure, the first thing obviously was to look out for a suitable field with not too many trees. You weren't worried about damaging a farmer's crop so much, but that you wouldn't tip over if you did, like the one in the book I showed you. The next thing was, of course, always land into wind. And it was essential in those days. Always land into wind. So it may not be obvious on an average day, unless you see some smoke, where the wind is coming from. So you should have in your head a rough idea where you're flying, in whatever direction you're flying in, where the wind is. Because you should know it from a navigation point of view, whether it's ahead or behind you or on port or starboard side. So you would have that in your mind anywhere where the wind was coming from. But on the other hand, you may not find a field that's in a suitable position. So then you may have to land crosswind, which again, in those types of old aircraft, was, you had to sort of fly the aircraft accordingly. You're landing crosswind, bank into the wind.
You say that. Can you explain, obviously, with the wind, how important wind was to biplanes and why you had to take off into the wind and why you had to try and land into wind?
In old biplanes, in particular for an inexperienced pilot, if you landed, came into land across wind, your path over the ground would, as well as going forward in the direction you landed, you'd have a side wind component which would be drifting off the ground. And if you landed, you'd rip the undercarriage off and probably wreck the aircraft.
At that stage, would you do side slipping as well?
Side slipping in biplane aircraft was an essential part of getting down. A, to get down quickly. If you were overshooting, you could. And there's nothing, in fact, in flying the old biplanes, there's nothing more wonderful than side slipping in. It's absolutely tremendous. You side slip in and then kick the rudder straight and come in and land. And particularly if you've come over the side of the airfield much too high, you can side slip, lose height very, very quickly. But you'd have to recover quickly, of course.
And the other thing I was interested in is, would you have to learn to restart the engine in flight?
No.
That wouldn't be part of the training with it at all?
No, no.
And could I ask a little bit about that kind of very basic stage of navigation when you were obviously just training and if you'd soloed, how would you navigate in those days?
Well, the only basic, forgetting the other instruments which you had, your wind speed indicator and I can't even remember what they're called now, your simple instruments. Your main thing was your compass. You didn't have a gyro compass or anything like that. And so you had the usual fluctuations on a compass, but you hoped that you were flying in the right direction, because you didn't want to keep altering your... You had to try and fly nice and steady. Otherwise, the compass was jumping all over the place. You also had to know the wind direction and calculate for drift. Because if the wind was coming from port, you'd probably have to bring the nose of the aircraft around more to port. Say you were flying on a course, say, of 180 degrees, and you had a wind coming from port, well, you'd probably have to, depending on its strength, but you'd probably have to fly on a course of 170 degrees to allow for the wind drift. So you were going across the ground. The aircraft wasn't going across the ground straight. It was at an angle.
And how would you tell wind direction? Because you said it was quite difficult if you had to spot where it was on the ground. How would you tell in the air?
You would hope from... You didn't really have MET briefings in those days, but you would have found out from somewhere what the weather situation was and where the prevailing wind should be coming from. But, I mean, I think even the professionals in those days... navigated by Baedeker, in other words, you know, railway stations and railway lines, more than roadways, of course. Roadways were not good things to follow. The railways were a great... And again, if you knew you were heading for a biggish town and you saw it coming up and it should be under you and you were way to the left or way to the right, you know, you'd know you've got to adjust.
And would you be carrying a map with you at that time?
Oh, yes, always carried maps, yes. But with open cockpits, they're a bit of a problem. So you had to have them folded, and you normally had them in your flying overall pocket.
Would it be difficult to pull the map out and sometimes locate where you were?
Well, with open cockpits, there's always a draft, and so you had to hold on to them and try and look at them. And of course, you had to also keep the aircraft straight and level while you were doing that, you see. So even on a short flight, it kept you busy, you know, it kept you occupied.
Was it easy, obviously, flying on the Wirral? Did that help navigation?
Obviously, flying locally helped you a lot. For instance, in the Wirral, you had the River Dee one side, you and the River Mersey the other. You also had the Welsh Hills. Though the Welsh Hills could be quite a hazard. Nevertheless, when I'd been solo for a few times, not more than a few times, what happened, 610 Squadron was mobilised just before war was declared, and we were all trying to get in as much flying as we could. And I used to go off on just flights, you know, just air experience. And I used to nearly always head for the Welsh Hills and the coastline around there. But of course, you knew where you were, it was easy, and with the rivers. But flying what I call locally was easy. It was when you went on to cross countries. And remember, the aircraft were flying very slowly. It took a long time to reach somewhere, and then you had to keep your wits about you and see if you could map read, you know, the whole way.
Prior to the war, did you have any experience of night flying? Night flying?
Not at this stage at all, no.
I was wondering with the cross-country navigation as well. Was that obviously when you left your locality, your normal location? Yeah. What would happen should you get into cloud and you couldn't obviously use many of the ground signs?
In the other stages, of course, except you were an instructor, you stayed away from cloud. I mean, and particularly, depending on the cloud cover. If it was, complete cloud cover, you just stayed out of it altogether. If it was, you know, I can't remember, something, was it 10-10 cloud cover, full time, something like that, 10-10. But if it was, you know, half cover, okay, you'd go above and play around, and it was good fun again, but you could still see where you were and what you were doing. Now then, if you started out, say, to fly from Hooton Park to, I'll say, South Wales, and the cloud base, and you wanted to stabilize, the cloud base got lower and lower. Well, the only thing you could do at that stage was turn around and come back. You wouldn't press on at all. Not with the experience you had at the time. And I'm talking just about, you know, pre-war, and war wasn't with us.
I want to ask you something about that, because obviously during the time that you were with the squadron, there was the Munich crisis. Was there anything that the squadron did at that time?
Certainly in the 12 or 18 months prior to the outbreak of war, and really I can only talk about my close friends, and most of my close friends were enthusiasts like myself. We were wishing for the war to come. We we were not against the war at all. It was a relief from the boredom of going to work and things like that. Let's have a war. Obviously, and that's of course when we became a fighter squadron, things got a little more intensive, the things you were doing, and I can't remember any particular stress on anything at the particular time of Munich, but to myself and to some of my colleagues, we more or less were wishing for war in our innocence.
I was wondering if the squadron maybe had any special preparations, i.e. camouflaging the aircraft or anything of that sort. Were you semi-mobilised at that period, though? Would you be with the squadron much more than generally?
We were... Switch off. Prior to the war, even though there was every indication that it was coming, the squadron as such just went on as normal. No camouflaging of the aircraft, no more intensive training, some bit more enthusiasm. But the first thing I knew, I was on holiday in France when we were mobilised, and I got a telegram from the squadron. And it's dated the 26th. When was war declared?
Was it the 26th of August?
No, this would be the... When was war declared? Remember?
It's September, 3rd of September 1939.
Well, this was the 26th of August, and I was ordered to return from France.
Before we go on to the outbreak of war, could I just ask you a couple of questions about the time when you were with the Auxiliary Air Force? Could I ask you about your flying kit? What you actually wore in those days?
God.
You mentioned overalls earlier on.
I don't think I can remember. I certainly got no photograph of it. I think we wore light overalls, you know, and a simple helmet. The only thing I have a difference between the helmet and the equipment worn later, we didn't have any radio communication between the instructor and the pupil. We just had voice tubes. And, of course, we had no radio communication with the ground. We had no oxygen. We didn't need it. We didn't go high enough. And you got bloody cold at times.
You mentioned also earlier that you had a cushion underneath your parachute.
Yeah.
Obviously you wore a parachute, but did you do any training should you have needed to have used that parachute?
I wore, from before the war, right through the war, only once did anybody mention to me that I was sitting on a parachute to use it. Basically, my parachute was my seat, and as the chance of using it, the odds were not too great, I hoped. I just forgot about it.
Was there any instructions, obviously, with something like the Avro Tutor, of how to leave the aircraft if you had to use a parachute, though? Would you have been instructed in that?
I don't recollect ever being instructed how to vacate an Avro Tutor or in any sort of emergency.
It sounds like there was more emphasis on precautionary or forced landings rather than vacating the aircraft in the air. The other thing I wanted to ask you just before we move on is, you mentioned obviously when you were a photographer earlier on, we didn't talk about the equipment you used, the types of cameras that you used.
Uh, Unfortunately, I can't remember the names of all the cameras we used. But basically, for in the air, both handheld oblique camera work and vertical fixed camera work, the camera was what called an F24, and I think we had something like a 4-inch lens and a 9-inch lens. But with the 4-inch lens, it must have weighed something between 24 to 30 pounds. So when you were using it over the side of the back cockpit of a Hawker Hart in the slipstream and held in by only one single wire, which wasn't tight holding you in because you had to be able to move around. If you went over a bump in the airflow, well, your feet left the ground and you clung onto the camera like mad. And you were bounced up against the gun rail around the cockpit, so you were bruised. Oh, but it was wonderful fun. I can't remember the rest. Oh, about the camera. The other main camera you used was a fixed one, which we normally used on a tripod. And it took an 8-inch plate camera. And you could do some fascinating work with that camera, but I cannot remember its actual name.
What was the fascinating work that you could do?
Well, I think it's because you could do so much with the plate. You could develop the plate like a film, but if it was too light, you could, using certain chemicals, I've forgotten the name, you could intensify it, or you could reduce it. Then if one part, when you were either enlarging it or reducing it, normally it was enlarging, and one section of the photograph was dark, you could block out the light with your hands, not holding it still, moving your hand, and bring up or reduce that section of the photograph. And so I say, you were painting with your fingers in a way, and it was wonderful fun and so fascinatingly interesting.
You were mobilised then on August the 26th, 1939.
Yes.
What was your reaction to that mobilisation?
Well, possibly just an indication, maybe of interest to someone in 300 years' time. I was mobilised. I was staying in a very small hotel, a place called Saban-sur-Mer, not far from Cannes in France. And I was told by the hotel, we'd been out, I was with my sister, that there was a telegram waiting for me at the post office, or whatever they call them, post offices in France. I went there and collected it, I still have it, and it was recalling me back to Hooton Park. By the time I got back to the hotel, virtually all the residents already knew that I was being recalled to England, and they were all packing up to go home. So probably I was one of the few people that started people thinking there was going to be a war in France.
And what happened when you got back to the squadron? What was the atmosphere?
On eventually returning to the squadron, things were very intense. And of course, we were then all regulars. And the more easygoing times of pre-war had gone. And and sergeants and corporals shouted and roared orders. And my first job was filling sandbags. And fortunately, we had a sandpit near Hoop Park. But then, of course, I had guard duties. And so in a way, flying didn't come into it then because we were sort of getting, it was war readiness. But gradually, the flying came back into it again, and to get as much flying experience as you could. But after something like 3 weeks, the squadron was sent to its war station, which was Wittering, I think. But as I had not completed my training and was still an LAC, I didn't go with the squadron, which was all very depressing for me. And then I was at the mercy of the sergeant in charge of discipline on the station. There he had one body who had nothing to do. So he found every job for me to do, from cleaning toilets to sweeping to cleaning windows. To... Fortunately, he only had me at his mercy for about 2 weeks when the order came for me to go to Reading to start flying training again.
Was that at number 8?
FTS.
Elementary.
Flying training at Reading, Woodley.
With that period, you said he had you at mercy. Was that just? You said the sergeant had you at his mercy, yeah, at RAF Wittering.
Not Wittering. No, I was still at Hoop Park. The squadron had gone, but I stayed at Hoop Park.
Was there any resentment there that you were an LAC who was flying?
I'm certain there was. Yes, I mean, because he hadn't been able to touch me or say a word to me, because there was no LAC. I was living in a world apart. I was in the aviation side, and he hadn't been able to give me any orders to do anything. Oh, he took advantage of it. Made my life hell.
So what happened when you got to Reading?
Well, when I got to Reading, it was another strange change in life for a while, because we went to a house called Hawkins. And this had been the house where all the pilots who'd been trained there previously, who'd all been civilians, had lived while they were training. They were going to be commissioned, but they were, and we went in this house. It wasn't all that huge. I forget how many of us live there now. Say about 10 of us. And we had two batmen in civilian clothes and white coats to look after us and feed us and make our beds. No one ever made a bed for me before in my life, you see. So I thought, oh gosh, this is heaven. The food is wonderful. So at whatever time in the morning, we used to stroll down to the airfield, say for 9 o'clock. And the instructors then were all civilians. And, I mean, the training was serious, but there were magisters we were being trained on. And we started, and I was allocated a New Zealander in his mid-30s, I should think. What was his name? Hooper. Flight Lieutenant Hooper, that's right. I'm valued, I've just remembered. And he used to always say to me, "I'll make a Stainforth out of you yet." Now, I don't remember Stainforth won the Snyder Trophy. So that always stuck in my mind. As I'd done quite a lot of flying, and I was starting from scratch again, I quickly went solo and got used to the magister.